provide conditions zu der Neuschwerpolitik and this translates to an arbitrary medical process that lacks consistency and flexibility. Of course, the proposed amendment will go a long way in ushering a new medical parole dispensation, and this new process will hopefully not be clogged by the usual bureaucratic red tape and the lack of transparency that comes with it. Once again, the substance of this medical parole process should be dealt with by the regulation, which would have to be presented to the portfolio committee of professional services for approval. To give place to the man. In 2006, Cabinet Rukoda took a decision to relocate remand detainees to DCS responsibility and mandated DCS to establish a remand detention branch to deal with all issues relating to remand detainees. This bill, among other, ensures that the existing policies and regulations, regulatory framework relating to remand detainees, are strengthened. The bill makes provision for remand detainees to have a prescribed uniform for the purpose of distinguishing them from sentence offenders and for the purpose of security services. The bill further makes special provision for treatment of certain categories of remand detainees. This would include pregnant women, disabled remand detainees, aged remand detainees, and mentally ill remand detainees. It is commendable that this bill seeks to regulate the period in which remand detainees are held both in prison and in police terms. If you look at clause 49E, it outlines the procedure in which a remand detainee who is terminally ill or severely incapacitated can be released on medical ground by the court through an application by the head of the remand detention facility concerned. And this section stipulates that if the head of the remand detention facility or correctional center, as the case may be, is of the opinion that a remand detainee is based on the recent advice of the medical practitioner treating that person suffering from a terminal disease or condition, or if a detainee is rendered physically incapacitated as a result of injury or disease, or in a choice to severely limit the activities or self-care. Secondly, the remand detention facility or correctional center in question cannot provide adequate care for such detainees. And lastly, there are appropriate arrangements for the remand detainee supervision, care, and treatment within the community to which the inmate is to be released. That head may apply to the court concerned in the manner set out in the session for the release of such detainees. The concern here is that this bill is not clear as to whether such remand detainees who are released on medical grounds may never have their day in court to answer for their actions or defend their case. Not clear whether if they are released forever or they still have to come to court to answer for their actions, because the bill is silent on that. Because if you look at clause 79(1)(b) on the medical parole, it states that the risk of offending must be low in order for an offender to be considered for placement on medical parole. However, this clause 29(e) is silent in terms of the risk of the remand detaining intimidating witness once released, because in most cases, before an offender can be released on bail, such factors are looked into account. Whether the offender, the remand detainee, can or intimidate witness, and so on and so forth. So this bill is silent around that level. Clause 49, 48. This clause provides that every remand detainee must wear a prescribed uniform which distinguish him or her from a sentence offender for the maintenance of security and good order in the remand detention facility. It should be noted that the remand detainees are in and out of the system at any given period. Some remand detainees are only in the system for a very short period of time. 2 days, a day, a week, and so on and so forth. I think it would be interesting to find out if this will be cost effective and sustainable for the department to provide uniform to such an unstable population. What about the practicality of this exercise? Is it practical? Those are some of the things that we hear from the department. Clause 49A, this sub den Vortrag im Kriterium in Politik. So, das will ich teilen daran. And there's no slide, but you are in terms of the role of the judicial, judicial inspection to that particular extent. So the bill is silent around those issues. General comment, the Blue Court Act makes provision for visits and communication for remand detainees. However, this bill is silent on those aspects, which are important, particularly for remand detainees, unless if they will be covered under regulation. Other issues, last feature, the department has acknowledged that there are financial implications for implementation of this deal, particularly around the demand payment and the medical power. It is thus essential that the department provides the portfolio committee with a concept implementation plan which should contain care constraints and cost for implementation. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Right. Anybody want to make any comments on this matter? Go right ahead.
Thank you, Chair Justice. And The other matter which concerns us, and I'm really grateful that this was raised, was that the question of when you have a new concept of remand detainee, it's not your deal with that at a later stage. At the moment you speak about remand detention facilities, you're speaking about places of incarceration. And to what extent has reference been made to the role of a judicial inspectorate in having being able to carry out its mandate in terms of the Act to deal with the conditions in these places of incarceration? Now, we're no longer speaking just of correctional centers. We must be satisfied as to the conditions in these facilities, and we must also be satisfied as to the treatment of people who are held in these facilities. And we don't think there's sufficient emphasis has been placed on the role that we, by legislative mandate, are required to play. And I think that is something which will definitely have to be reconsidered before this bill can be finalised. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The judge has touched on a couple of things I want to deal with. Just in relation to the last point that you raised, I think you will recollect that when we discussed this matter last year, I think we took a view of the committee that the judiciary
for example, in effect, the bill proposes that the mother would suspect that the child may be in custody of BCS or first have to fill out the three-page form A of the BCS, terms of access information. The form is available on the department's website in English only. In addition, she will have to pay the 35 rand Christmas fee at the BCS Control Financial Office, although the localities of these offices are not listed on the website. Such an office may be closed or may not be. Furthermore, the information officer of ECS is the National Commission in terms of Part 1 of the Act, and the deputy information officers are the chief commissioners and regional commissioners appointed by the National Commission. Presumably, these are the officials who would then make the request of information available. It's evident that this may have a significant administrative burden on these officials if they have to personally deal with every request regarding the detention of the remand event. Moreover, the website notes that the processing of the request may take 30 days or longer. At paragraph 21, the committee's attention is drawn to section 13(6)(d) of the Act, which reads, if requested by the spouse, partner, or neighbor of kin, the National Commissioner must, as soon as practicable, with the written consent of the inmate, give the details of the place where the inmate is detained. It should further be noted that section 13(6)(d) applies to all inmates, sentenced and unsentenced, and is also applicable as per the proposed definition of inmates in clause 1. It is therefore submitted as the reference to file be removed from the bill. At paragraph 24, the proposed section 49 capital B notes in two instances that the department will provide services that is able to command detainees within its available resources. This is a very unfortunate wording as it renders the section meaningless and without any enforcement. This able to command detainees are entitled to a certain minimum standard of detention, and this is not subject to what the department may want to afford or may have available or may want to actually provide. The particular wording of the first section 49(b)(2) refers to the rendering of additional healthcare services that may be rendered based on available resources. It's however not clear what the services are in addition to, or whether it refers to any additional services that a disabled detainee may require, but which an able-bodied detainee does not require. Moreover, many of the services required by disabled persons are of a non-medical nature. There's a proposed redrafting submitted in paragraph 25. I'm not going to read through that. I'm going to jump to paragraph 28. The proposed section 49F provides that the department may surrender remand detainee to the police for the purposes of further investigation for a period of 7 days, and that this may be extended, although no time limit to that extension is given in the bill. While the intention of this provision goes to the purposes of crime detection and law enforcement, the proposed amendment raises a number of important concerns. The warrant of detention made by the court specifies that the suspect must be detained by the Department of Correctional Services, meaning specifically that the department, that the person must remain in the custody of the department. Furthermore, unless specified as such, the warrant will not authorize the National Commissioner to release the person to any other entity unless they're authorized by the court. The proposed amendment will thus have the effect of the National Commissioner
committed for a sentencing defendant medical examination. Now, if you've got medical examinations that have been given to remand detainees who've been released and then readmitted out of SAPS care, I can understand why one wants to do that. But it's no use writing something into the Act that is simply not going to be adhered to because the facilities aren't there, the medical care isn't there, and it's just going to
and independent complaints directors. Now, my question is, first of all, it creates perception. If you look at Porter L. Vigas' presentation, it's even worse. With regard to all the protection and precautionary, you know, actions need to be taken and how to pull it apart. It creates a perception that torture is very rife in the police. Why don't you give somebody to the police that for the police to be tortured is very high? This is the one thing. Then, what is the reason that the Office of the Inspector General should be notified, given the jurisdiction of the Inspector General? Because this person is now out of the facility in the police custody. And what do you anticipate the independent director to do by notifying them that this person is now in the custody of the police?
Quickly, Chair, it is regrettably the case that there are significant high numbers of allegations of torture and ill treatment in police custody. We can look at the ICD's annual report. There are tens of thousands of cases that have been reported to the ICD, and I think it's only the tip of the iceberg. So I think we must put all the necessary safeguards and desperate measures in place to ensure that people need correctional services to get to the police, that they will have adequate protection. The purpose of informing the Office of the Inspecting Judge is to ensure that people don't get lost, and that they physically do not disappear. So we know that the Office of the Inspecting Judge knows that Minton has been transferred to the police for 2 weeks. Inform the IPD, make sure Minton comes back to the correctional services facility in good health. People do get lost, they do disappear. Then I think for the purpose of the ICD, they need to be aware that people from correctional services are currently in their custody. There is a whole range of issues around the authority of the warrant and how that process is managed and has been raised in the submission. The issue of transparency, we need to be aware of where people are and why they are there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Munting. I'm assuming you are taking notes so that you already been changing us on Thursday. Can we move on then to Mr. Noel Stott from Arms Management Program, and Mr. Sotlo also on behalf of the Sandra Gould in her presentation as well. I'm not sure it's okay to give both, but if you want to get us to the basis and do the other one, it's up to you.
With your permission, what I thought I would do was actually give Dr. Sandra Gould's time first, because it seems to dovetail from the previous presentation quite nicely. And as I've just said, I am doing two presentations, and obviously I don't work for two departments within the Institute for Security Studies, so I work with the Arms Management Program. So the first presentation, I'm not 100% clear on the issues, etc. So you could be just there with me a bit. But as I said, it dovetail with Lucas's presentation quite nicely. And I think, as well as the very first presentation, in terms of the cost implications of the remand detention grant. And basically, this presentation urges the committee to request the department to provide a full costing of the bill in terms of its implementation and operationalization with respect to remand detainees. Because it seems to us that the bill seems to make legal provision for the physical and other separation of remand detainees from sentenced inmates. If you look at the definition, it provides a definition for remand detention facilities as well as for remand harm detention officials. So this will have huge financial implications. And our concern is that the cost implications will be detrimental to the other services that correctional services provide, namely rehabilitation and reintegration. Going on to more specific matters, again, Lucas raised some of them in terms of Clause 5, Section 17 of the Principal Act is amended in terms of subsection 4, persons awaiting trial or sentence. We think because the definition of a remand detainee includes persons who are not serving a prior sentence, it is proposed that the words unsentenced offenders be deleted since it's redundant. In terms of page 5, line 45 of the Correctional Matters Amendment Bill, subsection 46.3 stipulates that section 624 of the Act applies to remand detainees, i.e. admission, accommodation, reading material, etc. And I think it was raised earlier this morning, the bill qualifies the requirements for the department to realize these provisions through the addition of the words as may be required by the context. We think this is widely open to interpretation, and that it is our submission that the words with such changes as may be required by the context be deleted from the bill. This was mentioned this morning as well. Another thing that was mentioned this morning, which is of great concern to us, is the provision relating to the Promotion of Access to Information Act of 2000. And we are informed by our view, by the Open Democracy Advice Centre, as reported in one of our journals, that the rate of mutually ignored requests in South Africa between 2003 and 2008 has been around 32 to 60%, and in terms of the Department of Correctional Services itself, it has a very poor track record in providing information in response to prior requests. We quote the judgment in the case of Treatment Action Campaign versus the Minister of Correctional Services, in which the judge stated that the papers in this case demonstrate a complete disregard by the Minister and his department of provisions of the Constitution and prior. We also give an example of a parent wishing to obtain information about a son or daughter that may be in remand detention, and I think this morning others indicated that it's a long process, costly, and in our view, any reference to prior should be deleted from the bill. In terms of clause 9 of the bill, page 699, in terms of pregnant women, which refers to the conditions of detention of pregnant women, again, there's this phrase, with such changes as may be required by the context. As per our submission above, we believe that this clause provides an unacceptable opportunity for the rights of pregnant remand detainees to be circumscribed, and thus recommend that it be deleted. In terms of disabled remand detainees, the bill states that the department may provide, within its available resources. Again, our concern with the wording is the same as mentioned above in relation to pregnant women, and it is our view that the clause should be reworded in the following way: the department will provide additional healthcare services, etc. The initiative in this regard. Requirements for the parole board to inform complainants or relatives, that's clause 13, page 11 and 91. The amendments of section 75 of the Act removes responsibility from the Commission to inform a parole board about a complainant or relative entitled to make representation to the board. The committee is urged to consider the fact that parole boards have limited resources and receive little support. This being the case, it is argued that it is unlikely that the board will have the capacity to identify and inform complainants or family members when information about the location and identity of those individuals is not provided. One of our simple suggestions would be the establishment of a dedicated telephone line or hotline to answer queries by victims and family members who need information about the timing and location of the parole hearings, etc. And then lastly, Chair, I think you asked for some comments on the medical parole issue and the cutting off people's arms by themselves. It is argued that whether the medical condition was self-induced or not, bear no relevance to whether the inmate should qualify for medical parole or not. Since the provision of medical parole is informed by the need to ensure that inmates suffering from severe illness or disability should be able to die dignified, there seems to be no reason to restrict this right, even if the inmate is deemed to be responsible for their condition. And we give the example of an inmate contracting AIDS through consensual unprotected sex. One could argue that that was self-induced. You then refuse to the inmate's medical parole seems nonsensical and a violation of the right to dignity. In addition, and a very sort of a cold point, I suppose, is that refusing such a person medical parole means that the responsibility for caring for that individual continues to fall within DCF at the cost of the taxpayer, a situation that surely cannot be justified. We thus propose deletion of section 79.4. It is our considered view that it is deeply problematic for the bill to be passed by Parliament before a thorough costing of the authorisation of the new system will remind that detainees have been undertaken and until the matters raised above are clarified and clear. On behalf of the Crime and Justice Programme, we thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, sir. Comment? Really
using the services of the Department of Health or the Provincial Department of Health. PLD having to go to the hospital and so forth. But what we're in essence doing for is we shift some of the burden which correctional services with a medical facility is rendering to the community in the Department of Health, which is also a cash strapped department. So those are more questions than answers, but perhaps we'll get some pause for response.
Thank you very much. Before we move over to you, can we just ask for further clarification around the information? So that I am clear about that. You were raising the fact that the fraud that is said might be indifferent to SARS or some other department might be instead of yours, and therefore it must be resourced. And so that I can formulate to really argue the department. That's what you were saying. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, the whole question, I haven't dealt with this in our report, but the question of medical parole obviously is something which has caused us great concern, particularly because of the large number of deaths which have been reported to us at the judicial inspectorate. Last year we had really close to 1,000 deaths again between the 1st of January and the 31st of December. I think it was 964 eventually. It could have been more because there were a few which were retarded, where the reporting was retarded. But many of cases also which particularly because they are called natural deaths, an unnatural death is usually not a problem because it's either a suicide or it's an assault which leads to the death of the person, but the so-called natural deaths were ones that have been causing us all this concern. Now, many of those cases, many of people who died natural deaths have already been so ill. I've mentioned before that I've seen them sitting there with glassy eyes, and you know that they are close to death, but there is no place where they can go because their families can't support them, and that's one of the problems. And I realize that appropriate arrangements for their supervision should be made, and that is clearly something which must be done. What does concern me is the whole question of physical incapacity. On one of my prison visits, I on two occasions I met up with people in wheelchairs, and the one was there for multiple rapes over a period of a long time. He happens to be in a wheelchair, so there's no way that I will ever get that man out of that prison. In fact, that's where he should stay until he dies. And another case is, from his wheelchair, while he was, before he was incarcerated, he was in fact the brain behind a whole criminal operation, leading to multiple robberies and so forth. So the mere fact that he's physically incapacitated should never, ever be regarded as a reason for medical parole. You first have to look at the exact circumstances of that person's injury leading to his becoming incapacitated. What is missing here is people who have mental incapacity. Now, of course it is so, that if you are mentally incapacitated at the time of the commission of the crime, you should never be convicted in the first place, because you are unable to form the intent to commit the crime. That is our law. Unfortunately, there are people who are persuaded to plead guilty to a crime where, in fact, they would be able to plead that they were mentally incapacitated at the time. And that is as a result of perhaps poor advice that they received from their legal advisors. So, and in a case like that, there should be a conviction. But it does happen that people like that are in fact incarcerated. They are convicted. They are sentenced. I would rather have a person like that considered for medical parole, where it is quite clear that this person is in need of chronic therapy. And where they say that he acts like a totally crazy guy day in and day out. A person like that, in other words, who is mentally incapacitated, should be considered for medical parole, as opposed to one who is merely physically incapacitated.
current form, the Act Medical Parole Process, doesn't have an appeal mechanism and allows for very good process, that one. And the other one is that although the subsection tries to put in place a monitoring system that tracks the offender's progress or lack thereof, it is not clear what is the purpose of an offender undergoing periodic medical examinations since the bill states that patients on medical parole may not be cancelled merely on their account to improve medical condition, etc. So, the one is, if you find yourself in a position which the judge mentioned, the incapacitation of mental incapacitation, but you fail, what do you think is the lack of a proper appeal procedure? And also, on this ongoing thing where the department bears clearly the cost to examine a person, but it is not the only way maybe to amend the conditions of the room.
Mr. Maxwell, I see you directed that question at me. It's not an easy question to answer. Because once again, every single case has to be dealt with on its own facts, its own circumstances, its own merits. The whole question of appeals and reviews, of course, will always come to the fore. But that is a procedural matter which is dealt with normally in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, and there is no reference to that in the Correctional Services Act as such. I don't think that would be taken into account by the parole boards when they consider whether or not medical parole should be granted. But of course, if you are properly advised, you would know when you should be bringing in an application for an appeal, even if it's long after the time period has normally lapsed for that kind of thing. Or alternatively, when you should bring a review application where the judge has granted an order which you should not have granted. For instance, where the judge acted irregularly by not referring somebody for an investigation in Falkenberg or something like that. I'm not sure whether that answers the question that you've put to me, but I don't think it would make too much difference to the suggestion that I've made as how I would prefer this to read.
Thank you, Mr. Sarfati.
I'm sure Max is looking forward to this presentation. This presentation is from the Arms Management Program of the Institute for Security Studies and focuses on the intention of the amendment to provide for the management and detention of remand detainees. So we don't look at other issues such as the medical paroles, etc. And one of our concerns, or our main concern, is that the bill does not deal with the key aspect of remand detaining detention experience, that is the use of force by correctional officials, in particular the use of less lethal and restraint equipment, and by that I mean electroshock devices, tear gas, batons, leg cuts, and belly chains. We believe that reviewing the use of this equipment is crucial for the bill if the proposal is to meet its stated purpose as to provide for the management and detention of remand detainees. Our submission thus provides recommendations on how the Correctional Matters Amendment Bill and therefore the principal statute, the Act itself, could be modified to better address these concerns. We of course agree that less lethal and restrained equipment can perform a legitimate role in the management and detention of inmates, including remand detainees. But we also believe that some types of such equipment are wholly inappropriate for use in detention settings. For example, the current South African legislation is virtually unique in permitting equipment condemned internationally as having no practical use other than torture and ill treatment. Other less lethal and restrained equipment can be accidentally misused or deliberately particular concern, given that the judicial inspectorate received over 4,000 complaints of inhumane treatment and over 2,000 complaints of assault by officials in 2008-2009. Now, obviously, it's not clear how many complaints were made by remand detainees, but they do constitute a large portion of the total inmate population. And evidence from a range of countries shows them to be particularly vulnerable to ill treatment. So basically, the submission looks at sun belts, sun shields, sun guns, batons, as well as drug ammunition and tear gas. And we make recommendations on each of those. And of course, we believe that the bill, and as you do, and the act itself, should be in line with Chapter 2 of the Constitution, which gives everyone the right not to be tortured in any way, and not to be treated or punished in a cruel, inhumane, or degrading way. And that, taking note of these challenges in terms of the use of such equipment, will ensure that South African legislation is consistent with university accepted standards and norms, including African and international, which is a commitment made in the 2005 white paper. To use one example at this point is that of stun belts and other body-worn electroshock devices. The use of this type of device has been internationally condemned as unacceptable. The UN Committee Against Torture recommended that stun belts be abolished as methods of restraining those in custody. The Council of Europe's Committee for the Prevention of Torture also opposes the use of electric stun belts for controlling the movement of detained persons, whether inside or outside cases of deprivation of liberty, as they call it. The European Commission has classified them as a device which has no practical use other than for torture and inhumane treatment. And as I said before, South Africa is virtually alone in its use of this type of device. At the time of writing, Amiga and ourselves are aware of only one other country, the United States, where they are in widespread use. And we believe that as remand detainees are particularly likely to be transported externally, there is a concern that they may thus face increased risk of wearing these belts compared to the rest of the inmate population. And we believe that the Department of Correctional Services produced in 2009, I think, purchased an additional 900 belts, more than doubling their stock. At this point, I wish also to refer to the recent, that is the October 2010 UN Human Rights Committee ruling against South Africa with respect to the use of shock shields in correctional centres. I'm sure you're all aware of the case submitted by Bradley McCallum in 2008. And the committee recently in October last year found basically he alleged that the correctional facility staff beating with batons and shock shields while he was lying naked on the wet floor, etc., etc. And the committee found such behavior constitutes a violation of his rights, and concluded that the state party, that is South Africa, is under an obligation to provide the author, that is, complainant, with an effective remedy, including compensation, reparation, etc. And of course, one measure that could be taken to prevent such cases is to ban the use of such shock shield in correctional centres. Just by the way, South Africa is required to submit to the committee in May. platform in space, that's things like belly chains and leg irons. The 2000 white paper on correction states that the department is committed to the maintaining of universally accepted standards and norms with regard to the treatment of offenders, including the standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners, which states that chains or irons shall not be used as restraints. So we also need to consider replacing those with more humane alternatives, as well as leg cuffs, for example. In terms of battens, we believe that the amendment bill should amend the Principal Act so that it incorporates the phrasing in the 2004 regulation that battens may only be used by correctional officials trained in their specific techniques for their use. But we would also want to see those provisions expanded to include all other such equipment authorized for use. There's a section on rubber ammunition. We feel that there's a need to clarify that the use of weapons equipped for firing rubber type ammunition are governed by the same principles governing the use of conventional firearms, and that they must only be used in situations that meet the criteria for the use of deadly force. For example, their use being only justified in self-defense, in the defense of others, and or to neutralize a threat to safety and security when the immediate threat is of death or serious injury. We need to specify exactly the type of rubber type ammunition permitted for use. We should state that the line of fire must never be directed above the waist, all those kinds of issues. Again, the need for training, and we can maybe hear from the department how much training is actually given. In terms of tear gas, at the moment there's no specification of the type of tear gas and the delivery mechanisms that are authorized for use in correctional service centers. And we made some recommendations in that regard. Again, the need for training that includes international human rights standards, etc. So, in terms of the Arms Management Program and the Amiga Foundation, we would be grateful if the portfolio committee could consider these comments in the light of our democratic values, etc., etc. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Comments?
Thank you, Chairperson.
don't have a problem with that. I mean, I think that is the correct approach. I think the only reason why we wanted to do the submission, because this was the opportunity to raise these issues, and because, as I said, the remand detainees do comprise a significant proportion of the population that we're talking about.
Bearing in mind that